This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live.
Adaptive practice, differentiation, can we honestly tell the difference? Is transforming this technology and this terminology a necessary step for teachers in 2024? Well, my name is Chris, and I'm choosing my debut show to declare that I'm a teacher who thinks the answer is a solid yes. So grab a cuppa, let's get started on this topical issue with a chance for even you to have your say in anything.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and you are listening live. Tune in live at ttradio.org, or to join in the conversation, download the Podbean app and search Teachers Talk Radio. Follow the hashtag TTRadio. Tune in, talk it out with Teachers Talk Radio.
Well, a very good afternoon to you all, and thank you very much for choosing to listen to me live today. And for those who are listening on the podcast providers, welcome also. So welcome to my debut broadcast on Teachers Talk Radio. My name's Chris, and as you can guess from the accent, I'm a teacher from the northeast of England. And I've had the pleasure of teaching for the last 10 years, and I've been excited to do this for as long as I've been doing it. And I'm actually also very excited to join the Teacher Talk Radio team. And I will be here on alternate Sundays to share with you topics that I believe are very close to the heart of our fellow teachers. So for my debut show, I've chosen to discuss the shift from differentiation to adaptive teaching. And I'll be here to navigate you through the pitfalls of modifying our practice that way. Because when we're faced with new terminology, to familiarize ourselves with it, our first reaction is to dismiss it as a fad, or to use what some people might say, it's a way for to keep people in jobs or TLA or whatever. But the truth is, changes like adaptive teaching have arisen because of a lot of research that has been undertaken by experts who, through copious amounts of data, have been able to analyze what impact it would have. So I'd like to show you today what impact adaptive teaching has and why it trumps differentiation as a plan and method. However, as it is my first show, I thought it'd just be a good idea to share with you how my shows will be formatted. So whilst today's topic does have the main feature of adaptive teaching, I would also like to allocate a segment of the show to a shallow dive into key observations in my teaching that I've witnessed in the last week or so, and just to reflect on any current affairs that are shaping our educational landscapes at the moment. So let's get going straight away and see how we get on with this. So it is my debut show, like I said, so it is new to me doing shows like this, but I just think it's absolutely, when I stumbled across Teacher Talk Radio, I thought it was an absolutely amazing thing to get involved with. So I might be a bit nervous to begin with, but hopefully you will see that, you know, I have the passion for this and we've got a lot to discuss. So my teaching week began on Monday with a learning visit from our quality department. And whilst it was a normal lesson and I observed normal practice, it was still nevertheless evident that a third party was in the room. And, you know, I've, like I said at the top of the show, I've been doing this for 10 years and I always still find that I appear a little goofy to the observer. And I always find that in these situations, you're never too far away from it slipping out of control, where, you know, or at least you have that fear that, you know, you're moments away from it slipping in, out of control. But I have been reflecting on this, and since Monday, I've had a lot of thought about this, and I do think it's a positive emotion. I think it's important to, you know, be disciplined in the classroom at all times when you're being observed. But it's also helped me to discipline me into maintaining my routine, because again, it could be quite easy to try something new or try to show off. And it doesn't, people see through that, don't they? And least of all, most of all the students, they're the ones who see through that the most, don't they? So having that fear of it slipping out of control helps maintain, I believe, the balance there. So I do wonder if this is a normal reaction. Does everyone feel the same way about this? Does anybody ever really, you know, handle lesson observations well? They might do, but do they, under the surface, do they feel it? I mean, can the fear ever leave you? And should it leave you, in fact? Because if it does leave you, then perhaps maybe the emotion isn't there to begin with. So, upon reflection, being absolutely fine with it, being fine with having the fear keeps you going. So no matter how comfortable you are with your group, there's always going to be that element, isn't there? And yet, ironically, there are times, isn't there, when you actually wish somebody was in the room at the time observing you, when you've shown good practice, and especially when it leads to amazing results. My main discipline is politics, but I teach law too. And when I teach law, and there's very critical concepts that students need to understand, it's not necessarily something that they'll understand first time. And you know, when the light bulb moment happens, it is good to see. And you know, it would be nice if somebody was there to witness it, but just selfishly, because it makes you look good, doesn't it? But you know, the truth is, you do it anyway. And and when they are in the lessons, when they are observing the lessons, it can appear, can't it, that something's going to go wrong. But I never find it seamless to remain entirely normal. And I actually thought as well about this, that it's actually more difficult to appear normal in these situations or demonstrate normal practice, because you would normally have to produce the documentation that you have to as well. Of course, you would have a lesson plan. Of course, you would have a scheme of learning and such. But all the other things that you have to do just to prove what you normally do, it's difficult. And it's been a bit of a crazy week for that. But the good news was I got some good feedback on it. So it goes to show that that emotion does help you in these situations, doesn't it? So I intend to explore this in great detail, and just to think ahead for future shows, I plan on exploring this in great detail. So if you are listening and you want to get involved with the show, whether or not that be from a teacher and a learner point of view, or if you have recently been observed yourself as a teacher, or again, if you conduct teaching and learning observations, I'd love to hear from you, because you know, whether that's as a routine practitioner or if you're an early careers teacher, either way, please let me know. So I have, you can drop you can DM me on LinkedIn, but I do now have Twitter. I've blown the dust off my Twitter, and I've started to use that instead. So my hashtag handle, I sound like a dinosaur. It's just a handle, isn't it? My handle is Chris_1987. So that's Chris_W1987. And if you want to get in touch with me that way, please feel free to, and we'll have a discussion further about learning visits as well.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncattbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading.
So I'd also like to dedicate a portion of today just to celebrate the incredible mothers in education, with it being Mother's Day. And as we honour Mother's Day, let's just take a moment to recognise the remarkable women who are not only nurturing their own families, but they still get up in the morning, they still come into their place of work, whether that's school, whether that be colleges, and they just produce absolutely amazing work to help shape the minds of future generations as well. So to all the mothers education, I applaud your effort and your dedication and your selflessness to both. And in order to do that, I have found, look at this. Now wait, there's more. So, you know, your impact goes beyond the textbooks and the lesson plans, and you help shape future every single day. So thank you for that. And finally, you know, as International Women's Day was on Friday, I'd personally like to acknowledge the continued and remarkable contributions of women in education also. Because, you know, women have been pioneers in the field of education for so many years. And, you know, they've helped break down barriers for future women coming into the profession and helping to reshape all the landscape of all generations, and not just young girls but boys also. And without our women, we really would have education would be in a much worse position, of course. So from leading universities to grassroots education initiatives, women educators have played a pivotal role in fostering knowledge, education, and critical thinking. So the passion, intellect, and resilience have all been towards that. So whether you are a mother in education or a woman shaping the lives and minds in classrooms, we thank you for your tireless efforts and your boundless impact as well. So happy Mother's Day, happy International Women's Day to all the incredible women up there. Your work really does make a better place. Now, what I'd like us to do is turn to the attention of adaptive teaching, because I think the concept of adaptive teaching will take quite a while. And I do also think that it's important to acknowledge what it is that I will be doing today and you know, what I won't be doing, because, you know, I actually started thinking about what to do for this topic, for this show. And I looked at it and thought, well, maybe, you know, maybe we'll start with some scaffolded questioning, because that's what I've been doing recently for my MPQ. So I'm doing an MPQ in leading, teaching, and development. And one of the first things we learned to do, or, you know, did more work on, was scaffolded questioning. And I actually thought I knew a lot about scaffolded questioning, to be honest. But it turns out there's a lot more to learn than what I did. So I'm getting the best CPD on this. And I did start off by looking at scaffolded questioning and thinking, right, should that be today's session? And the more I got into it and the more I looked around this, I ended up just going back to the original concept of just adaptive teaching and thinking, well, why don't we start there? And we might get there today. We might get there with a scaffolding question. If, for example, you know, we look at a case study, or if any of you listening would like to come on and have a chat about that, then, you know, of course, we might get there. But I think additional scaffolded questioning could very well be its own thing. It could be its own show as well. So, and I don't want to stretch it too much today. I do want to focus purely on how adaptive teaching has changed and how it's changed from, you know, from differentiation. And then we'll see how, like say, how we get on and go from there. So adaptive teaching. So this topic has been embedded in my practice for some time. But again, you know, it's a lifelong learning thing. You know, what I think is adaptive teaching is different to what other people do. And do you know what? We're both going to be correct as well. And this is the point. So whilst I, in my recent observation, was told that I do a lot of adaptive practice and you know, I know that my planning leads to that, there's still a lot to learn, and it's just there's a lot to tap into, isn't there? So, you know, I've recently led some CPD on this in my school, in the topic of my school, and I just felt as my debut, it was something that just, you know, required attention. So, adaptive teaching is a concept that's been gaining traction in education for a couple of years now, and it's about tailoring our teaching methods to meet the individual needs of each student. So today I'll unpack this idea and explored implications, not just for students, but for teachers also. And this is a teacher's show, of course. And so, you know, what better thing to do than talk about how this can benefit teachers too, and not just students. And I'll sort of leave that a little bit, I'll leave that hanging for a little while. So perhaps maybe to get you to think about that yourself. So I'll just dangle that for the time being. As a thing about teachers, but I promise I will answer that and get in touch. And if you would like to get in touch with how perhaps you have helped with that as well, or to how it helped you, please feel free to. So here's a question to ponder. And if I drop this question at you now, and then I'll just keep reviewing the question as we go through, just to give you a bit of time to think about this as well. So for listeners on the live broadcast, I'll go silent for, you know, about 10, 15 seconds, not long. Okay, so it'll be a brief pause, but it'll allow you some thinking time. And of course, this is what we do in the classroom, isn't it? We, you know, if we ask a question, we don't expect an immediate response. And in fact, when it does go quiet, we should be happy with that. We should be embracing the fact that quietness is almost them thinking aloud, hopefully. You know, the silence should be a good thing, really. So I'm going to ask you this question. If you're on the listening back on the podcast, please feel free to pause at any point, of course, if you require further thinking time. So make a note of your answer, or at least just a mental note, but we'll do, of course. And we'll, like I say, we'll review this as times as we go through. So I'll ask the question, and then I'll just go silent just to give you a bit chance to think about it. So, why do you think adaptive teaching empowers students to take ownership of their own learning journey more than differentiation? Okay, so hopefully that's given you a bit of time to think about it. So it really does get to the heart of this issue, doesn't it? So I'm asking you really two things, possibly even three. I'm asking you off the bat straight away, how do students take ownership of that? I mean, that's the crux of the question. But in terms of differentiation, how does that differ from that? And I think a bonus question could be, as teachers, how do we empower that as well? Okay, I don't want to confuse you too much, though. I'm just going to stick the original question, but it's layered, and it'll give us a chance to unpack this a little bit more. Now, we know that adaptive teaching is tailoring our teaching methods to meet the individual needs of each student. We know that from, even if you didn't know that, because I've mentioned earlier, and just that's the definition, we know at least that's what that is. But what we, like I say, we need to unpack is how that has an impact on the teachers and pupils. And, you know, as educators, we really need to know what the impact of things are. If we're going to buy into something and we're going to look at this and say, do you know what, this is what we need to do. This is what how we're going to help students to achieve their goals. We need that buy-in, don't we? And, you know, that buy-in comes from knowing what the impact is. And, you know, that can come in all different forms. And I don't have the exclusive impact today. In fact, with the time that we have, I would probably only scratching the surface, really. But the impact is there. It is visible from the moment you start employing adaptive teaching. So according to the early career framework, if you are an early careers teacher, or if in fact you are a mentor of some description, or you are a teacher and learner practitioner, there will have been at some point a chance for you to have read the early career framework, and it's littered with adaptive teaching. So we know from, you know, almost immediately as early careers teachers, anybody coming in now as early careers teachers will be given this. It'll be thrown at them, and it'll be lots of different ways in which this could be put out there to them as well. But however they do it, nevertheless, it's there. Okay, it's absolutely there, and it's not going anywhere. So it's just important to understand how it works for us. Okay, So the early, like I say, the early careers framework tells us that it's about addressing students' individual needs, and this is the clincher here, whilst minimising additional workload for teachers. So the early careers framework really has taken on board all the various ways in which the previous teachers and the previous frameworks have been quite insistent on, you know, on things that have led to teachers' workload. So the early careers framework really is looking can you get the maximum impact without, you know, a great deal of teacher workload beyond what's expected, of course. So standard 5 defines it as providing an opportunity for all pupils to experience success by adapting lessons while maintaining high standards for all, so that all pupils have the opportunity to meet expectations. Now, that is about as positive as you'll get. And you know what? I think, you know, education departments, you know, Ofsted and in all these other authorities, they do get a lot of criticism. They do stand for a lot of criticism at times. But, you know, personally, I think that's about as positive and as heartening as you can get, really. Because ultimately, that is the dream for teachers, isn't it? But you might also be thinking, because, you know, for those who aren't aware of the early careers framework, and because perhaps maybe, again, you're not an early careers teacher or you don't work with early careers teachers, so you may just be familiar with the old frameworks instead, just because that's what you were trained to do. And so you might be looking at this and thinking, well, what does that look like in the classroom? And I'm probably already doing this. So did differentiation not just do this instead? Why do we have to change it? Could we not just say that's what differentiation is? You know, because if we kept it at differentiation, then at least we would get buy-in from the older teachers. I would classify myself as an older teacher, so I'm certainly not trying to say that as a bad thing. I just mean, you know, people who have been in the profession for a while. Could we get buy-in by keeping the word differentiation but changing the definition for this? Well, you know, I say the answer is no. We had to scrap differentiation, had to go. It was the right decision. And differentiation does not do half the things that adaptive practice does. And I'll show you. So let's address that. And so what we're going to do is I'm going to read out some features of differentiation. And what we'll then do is have a look and see, what do all these features have in common? So we'll stick with differentiation for the time being, okay? Just differentiation. But what do all these have in common compared, you know, to what we're going to look at in a moment, okay? So let's read them. So different features of differentiation are the following, okay? So we have, and again, this is an exclusive list. There's quite a few different features. I've just picked out some that I think are probably most recognizable to most people. So the first thing is, with differentiation, it required individualized learning plans. Now, individualization, differentiation, however you know you want to phrase it, it still required individual learning plans. Now, that sounds great if you're one of those individual learners. Don't get me wrong, okay? It's not entirely wrong what differentiation was doing, of course, but you know, that in itself, individualized learning plans can cause problems. So that's the first one, okay? Individualized learning plans. Another one was resources, but an array of pre-planned resources as well. So not just resources for all or to deal with a topic. It was pre-planned resources that fed into the individual learning plans. And mini lessons for different groups of learners. Okay, so What we mean by that is we look at a lesson and we can see that two students are having completely different lessons through differentiation. It may be the same topic, don't get me wrong. I mean, you're not going to, you know, if, as a history teacher, you're not going to I'm not a history teacher, so I'm making this up, but, you know, you're not going to teach the Treaty of Versailles and Potsdam and Yalta in the same, you know, in the same lesson. Of course, you're going to teach the same topic. But what I mean by pre-planned lesson resources and mini lessons is that there might be different activities per student. And that was what differentiation was encouraging teachers to do. And the last one is learning objectives that had words like must, should, and could. So as an example, all learners must get to this point. Okay, not too much wrong with that, because that might have to be the case. But it's the should and the could. It's the they should be at this point by the end of the lesson, or they could be. Now, should and could aren't particularly progressive words, I would say, that encourage things like adaptive teaching. Now, again, I haven't shown you any features of adaptive teaching yet. We are still just focused on differentiation, but you can see there that these are there's clear factors between each one. Okay, so what I'd like you to do is have a think about this. Okay, what have all these got in common? So I'll say them very quickly again. So mini lessons for each for different groups of learners, an array of pre-planned resources, individualized learning plans, and should and could words for learning objectives.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncattbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading.
This is Teachers Talk Radio, and this is Teachers Talk Radio News.
This week in the news. Is World Book Day a burden on parents? Has the tide turned against hyper-discipline in schools? Is Scotland going to be excluding more students? Should we be talking up the benefits of going to school at a school that is turning the clock back on mobile phones? World Book Day on March the 7th has become a fixture in the school calendar, where pupils are encouraged to come to school dressed as their favourite characters, or bring books to donate or tell their friends about. This celebration of reading, though, has become a little controversial, as reported in the BBC and The Guardian. Parents have complained of increasing pressure to buy commercialised costumes or spend time and money elaborately creating their own. Some of the pressure has a class element, with some parents sending their children to school dressed as characters from Harry Potter, while others might be the Artful Dodger. Head teacher Fran Davis from Michigan Primary School in Mountain Ash has said she wants the day to be fun without being a financial burden. Therefore, she suggests that pupils can come in their pajamas, suggesting their favourite bedtime book, or simply in school uniform, as they might be pupils at Hogwarts or even Greyfriars. If you wish to hear teachers' views on World Book Day, listen to last week's Late Show with Lucy Neuberger on Teachers Talk Radio. One of the most significant developments in education in the last few decades has been the trend towards positive discipline, or military-style discipline, in schools. And this provides the context for the next two stories this week. The first story appeared on the BBC and was covered by the Guardian newspaper. And it's about the Michaela School, led by the controversial head teacher, sometimes described as Britain's strictest head teacher, Catherine Burwell Singh, who has been in the news for the school's policy towards Muslim prayers. Half of the pupils of the school are Muslim students. Two students have given interviews where they describe a toxic atmosphere of the school and an atmosphere of fear and being stripped of their identity. If you wish to learn more of this story, you can find Tom Rogers' interview with Catherine Burble Singh on this topic on Teachers Talk Radio. The increasing prevalence of tiger-style teaching, strict discipline methods, zero tolerance, and first-time, every-time expectations of students across British schools was highlighted when a parent at Boston Spa Academy complained her autistic son found school intolerable, as over a period of only a few days, he acquired 56 negative comments and several days in isolation. Boston Spa Academy schools have appeared frequently in Education Uncovered and other news outlets for their strict approach involving lining up for inspections and an expectation that rules will be obeyed instantly and at all times. Not for the first time, teachers' unions have described these policies as inhumane. This week, Scotland's Education Secretary, Jenny Gilruth, announced that there would be a review of Scottish Government's policy on exclusions. The number of exclusions from schools has dropped considerably in recent years, as a determined policy of avoiding school exclusion was adopted following research of a link between excluded students and later involvement in crime. However, with one-third of teachers in Scotland reporting in a survey of the EIS union that they had suffered assault or physical violence in the previous year, pressure to review the non-exclusion policy has resulted in a reconsideration. School attendance is once again in the news. A survey revealed that nearly a third, 32% of teachers and school leaders have experienced pupils being absent this academic year because of a parental dispute with the school. The survey by Teacher Tap asked 8,411 teachers and leaders in state schools in England in January what reasons they had been given for pupils missing school this academic year, other than illness. More than half, 51%, said pupils had been kept home because they were tired after an event the night before. Nearly 9 out of 10, 87%, said wanting to take a holiday during term time was the reason, while more than 3 in 4, 76%, pointed to family events. John Camp, president of the Association of School and College Leaders, warned in a speech to the union's annual conference that the unwritten social contract between families and schools is fracturing, and he called for a change of tone in the national conversation about education to ensure that people talk up schools and colleges. And finally, another story from the BBC, where Milldown Academy in Blandford Forum head teacher Mr. Law has adopted the policy of providing brick phones, old-fashioned simple mobile phones for students. Parents can hire or borrow them as an alternative to smartphones, which are increasingly distracting in the school. You can find more discussion of these and other stories on Teachers Talk Radio or reviewed each Sunday on Teachers Talk Radio panel, which you can find the links to on YouTube or the Teachers Talk Radio site. This has been your Teachers Talk Radio news with John Gibbs.
Hello and welcome back to Teachers Talk Radio. I'm Chris, your host till 2:30 today. And I left you before the news break just with a question, just getting you to think about how things go. But before I tap into that question, I just want to say hello to everybody who has who's messaged me on the chat there. So to Nevin and to Toby and to Joe and Chuck and Susan, no less, from Buenos Aires. And I can imagine there's a huge difference from Liverpool to Buenos Aires, but no, it sounds amazing. So it's lovely to hear from you all as well. So the question I asked you beforehand was just, you know, what do all these things have in common? Now, I put this down as being it was onerous and burdensome on the teacher. So I think that asking teachers to make additional tasks to meet the various needs of students is something that we have to do from time to time. Of course we do. Now, when you consider things like, you know, students with SEN or with their EHCP, then, you know, we're not at all querying that. And as teachers, we want to do that, in fact. But, you know, for some students and some pupils, I do use the words pupils and teachers and students interchangeably as well. So I do apologize if there's any confusion there. But, you know, we do look at students and we think, well, you know, what is it that we need to, why do we need to give them that additional task? Is it because of the EHCP, or is it because they're a SEND learner? Or is it because we're just trained through differentiation to think, well, that student's underperforming, so we have to give them something different to somebody who's overperforming, or, you know, exceeding the expectations? And, you know, of course, the major factor here is that both learners, you know, whether it be at the extreme end of either way, they have completely different outcomes. And, you know, quite often, invariably, the student who is at the detriment of this is those who need the most support, because ultimately differentiation provided a ceiling to learners, and it actually capped expectations as well. So we see students who, if they're only having to achieve a C for their work, not being able to see what an A grade looks like, then, you know, they are going to be capped. And actually, you know, you could also argue that the students who are exceeding expectations are also capped as well. Because I actually had a learner this week in my class, and because we've got mock exams next week, which no doubt will feature as a segment in the future. But we've got mock exams next week. And one student in particular said to me, you know, I actually revise better, or I learn better when I'm teaching. So, you know, she was very good at learning, you know, her own individual things like cases and ACT and, you know, all the other things that's needed for the exam. But she thrived when she was able to help others. And so differentiation wouldn't allow that. It just simply wouldn't. It wouldn't allow the top students to thrive. They would just be capped themselves to a degree, but at least they would be at the higher level, as it were. The students who are underperforming would still be capped, because again, there's a ceiling to that. So what adaptive teaching really trains us to do, or what we really should be training ourselves to do at this point, is look at how not to preordain the student's learning experience. How not to produce rigid lesson objectives, or plan or to signpost them to, you know, a particular route where they, you know, they're capped, they're limited. Because as a consequence to this as well, it's easy to forget that it is possible that the needs of certain students may not be planned in advance. And I think differentiation put too much pressure on teachers to have that pre, you know, that pre-planned notion of how the journey is going to go for them. So adaptive teaching just simply eradicates all of that pressure, and it gives the authority back to the teachers to decide in-house and also live time how the lesson's going in the moment. So yeah, in answer to that question, ultimately differentiation does that. Now, don't forget the question I asked at the beginning of the show, so I'll ask it again, just because we're just about to perhaps maybe start answering this question now. I think it's fair to say that we're you know, we are in a better position to answer this. And I know, Tom, at the top of the show you said, oh, that's a tough question to answer. Well, it is, and you know, I'm not saying I've got the answers by any means, but you know, we can at least have this, you know, we can have a conversation about it at least by just looking at what we have. So the question was, why do we think adaptive teaching empowers students to take ownership of their learning journey more than differentiation? And of course, we haven't looked at adaptive teaching yet. We are sort of working our way towards that, but at least we can dismiss differentiation as a way of allowing students to take ownership of their learning. We can't dismiss it entirely. Like I said, that was some good practices, and you know, that's great. And then the situations, that's great. But as a whole, differentiation doesn't allow that. So at least we know that we're getting towards looking at adaptive practice and how that dismisses that notion. So if we compare the features of adaptive teaching, okay, and just look at how this differs from this as well. So adaptive teaching really focuses support for young people more, okay? It tweaks the lessons. It allows you to make them tweaks as the lesson goes on. It doesn't stop you from looking at it in the moment and going, do you know what? This is working for Billy, but it's not working for Tommy. You know, it's not working for person, you know, Billy's table, because they're all higher levels and that's just how it's worked out. But then Tommy's still missing out as well. So, you know, it's not working for them. What can we do? So judging in the moment whether pupils are coping is such a important thing that teachers should be empowered to do. And adaptive teaching empowers teachers to do that as well. So the needs are catered by tweaking the lesson. And it identifies in the moment who might need more scaffolding. And, you know, the starting points are planned, of course, but the starting point should be planned so that all students are successful and that all students are at the end of a particular point, they're all there. Okay. We'll have none of this about all you need to do is get to a C and you're exceeding your expectations. No, let's show them exactly what the full picture is and let's get them there. Now, how we get them there differs, and I would like to share with you some of my practice in a little while, but you know how we get them there does differ. So how do we do that then? So what is it that we do to make sure that these things happen? Well, first of all, we would say that the Education Endowment Foundation, they have set up some, you know, they've told us what to do in real time. And if you're not aware of the Education Endowment Foundation, they are absolutely fantastic. Okay, they have so much research that's been put into how to make learners learn better and stronger, make them just that finished article more than they would be before. So if you've never been to the Education Endowment Foundation, if you've never heard of them, now's your opportunity to get involved and have a look at what they do. So they've told us that there's really four things in the cycle. So in an adaptive teaching cycle, there's four things we need to do. So the first thing is we need to anticipate. So that's where your planning comes in. And our planning is always going to be a big part of our practice. And that doesn't change. You know, we're not saying, you know, the workload that differentiation does, it doesn't eradicate, you know, the workload isn't eradicated from the planning. So we still have to anticipate things. Now, what are we actually anticipating? Well, I think we are anticipating barriers, okay? And so does the Education Endowment Foundation. So what barriers are we going to see in the lesson today? So, and again, that barrier can come from all sorts of different things. So one barrier might be that a pupil might not feel comfortable with something. And if you know that in advance, that's a really handy thing to know. Now, why might not they be comfortable with it? Do they not have the skill set? Is there something outside the classroom that's affecting their ability to understand this? You know, there's all sorts of reasons. But the point is that's a barrier just as much as anything else. Now, the most notable barriers, of course, are special educational needs, if they've got an EHCP. But again, it could come down to social things as well. Now, of course, knowing the barriers or anticipating the barriers means absolutely nothing if you're not going to address them barriers through your planning. So I have a very bespoke lesson plan that I use, and nobody else I know uses this lesson plan because I have adopted a few different areas of research to create it. Now, it sort of takes the form of Ross Morrison's 5-minute lesson plan, but it's more like a, I would say it's more like a 10-minute lesson plan than a 5-minute lesson plan, because I have a section on there about barriers, and it might be it's a standard item. So I've got one particular student in my one of my groups that I have a standing item for them. It's every lesson, no matter what, they're always going to need to do certain things, or they have to be made to feel welcome in a certain way. So in a way, that item could almost be not written up, but if it could be, it could be typed up, and it could be on every lesson plan moving forward. But that isn't always the case, and you know, sometimes we just know that a learner's not going to do particularly well on a particular subject. Now, for my subject, prior knowledge isn't a thing. You can't, unless you've done GCSE law or GCSE politics, or you've got a huge interest in it, which some of them do, that prior knowledge isn't there. So one of the barriers isn't that they don't know the subject, because that's what they're there to learn. They're not here to already have the subject, and I'm going to pounce on them with, you know, high order thinking skills questions, you know, nothing like that. You know, I don't expect any of my students to even know who the current prime minister is at the beginning of the year. And if they do, bonus, but I don't expect them to in a politics lesson. I expect them to be taught it. But so that's not the barriers I refer to. A barrier for me is, well, actually, this person in the last assessment didn't put any cases in their work, or in my politics class, they didn't provide any examples. And I'm sure as history teachers and as GCSE English teachers, you know, as Toby is, whatever your discipline is, often examples are needed. So something from the text, or Joe, I know that if in history it would be a source, wouldn't it, from history? And so, you know, in these situations, you know, if you know that the students aren't doing that well, that's a barrier. That is a barrier. So, you know, so-and-so just refused to put cases in, or they don't provide examples. And someone in my second year law group, they just can't evaluate. They've even told me that. So I don't like it. I don't like it. I don't like to evaluate. I would avoid any evaluation question. And you're like, no, you can't do that, of course, because evaluation's pretty much half the paper, I'm afraid. So that's a barrier. So how do we address that? We address it throughout planning. And again, that might be a standard item, but it might just be for the last bit of homework, they didn't do it. So that might go on the lesson plan, thinking, right, I'm going to make sure today that they leave the lesson maybe not fully off air with evaluation or with cases, but we're going to move them on. We're going to move them up. I'm going to model them. I'm going to model it. I'm going to show them, and they can do it. So whatever it is, we're going to move them on. So we address that through the barrier. Now, the third element comes in the class. So notice how the cycle of four elements, there's only two that we do before the lesson. In fact, of the two, there's only one that we really have to document, you know. So it's the planning of the barriers. Now, we anticipate the barriers, and you might document that, but at least if you're aware of it when you're planning, you've got that avenue. So the other things come from inside the classroom, and this is a big, big difference from differentiation, this next part. Okay, so adapting your lesson in the moment, not necessarily the resource. Now, that particular thing there is so, so important, and such a huge difference from differentiation, that adapting in the moment. Now, I use whiteboards, and I think they're an absolutely fantastic resource. I can't speak highly enough for them. And at first, I was a bit skeptical of whiteboards, because I thought, they're going to be distracted, you know. I'm just thinking, what would I have been like as a student with a whiteboard? I'm probably going to doodle. I'm going to write a silly message and show my friend at the other side of the classroom. And I'm anticipating all these things that students are doing. But, you know, it becomes a mainstay in my lesson. So if you were to observe a lesson this year, in my class, there's a very, very good chance that whiteboards will be being used. And I use them because they really help with adaptive practice. Now, I might start off with a closed question, and I'm going to slightly tip into scaffolded question here, but more as a just as a feature of adaptive practice rather than, you know, a whole segment on it. But I might ask a closed question at the beginning of the lesson. Now, this question might be a really, really simple question. And it's just so I know that everybody's already there. So I might say, who is the current Prime Minister? And I might do that day one of my politics class. And every single person writes Rishi Sunak except one. One person writes Boris Johnson. Or worryingly, they might put Tony Blair, you know, or something like that. So they might do that. And then I know immediately we can't move on yet. Okay, that student needs to be with everybody else. But what do we do? Do we just, everybody else has got the answer. So do we just wait until that person gets it and everyone else has sit there and wait? Well, no, because the whiteboards are really good for this. And quite often, you know, if I say, right, everybody show your boards and they'll do it, whoever's wrote the wrong answer will quite quickly just go, oh, okay, and they'll quickly rub it out and write it in. And they tend not to be too embarrassed by getting the answer wrong. Of course, if you think that they would be embarrassed by that, then that's a barrier that you would address beforehand. But you know, if you've been in the class with your students in September, and it's now March, you've got a good idea that that is, and embracing mistakes as well, you know, because mistakes are education as well, aren't they? So you know, whiteboards are really good for that. But you know, let's just say they all get it right, we can move on. I might use a whiteboard later on down the line as well for a more challenging question, like a higher order thinking skills question or something like that. And I do this quite a bit actually. So the question I asked you about, why do we think adaptive teaching empowers students to take ownership of their lesson more than differentiation? Let's just say we wrote that on the whiteboard. You know, that's an open question. So you're going to get different answers, aren't you? Of course you are. Now, as students are writing this down, I do pre-warn them as well that I do tend to hover around. You know, I do tend to walk around, weave through the tables just to see what they're writing. And it's what's really good is spotting a mistake early. And it might be that I've got a pen in my hand and I'll just write something to prompt them. Or I might even have a rubber in my hand. I'll just rub it out and say, not quite, try again. And the idea of using whiteboards means that they're not making mistakes on their work. They're not doing anything. And the mistakes, it's all low stakes quizzing as well, isn't it? So, you know, there's no real problem with doing that. So I tend to wipe it off the board and say, try again. No, and it just might be that I have to do that with everyone. That's when the lesson has to take a different form. And I'll always provide objectives, I'm sure we all do, before the lesson, but I actually don't think there's anything wrong with adding objectives throughout the lesson. And I think this is something that doesn't get mentioned a lot, I don't think. I don't know. I suppose as a question to those listening, do you think you would add an objective in the middle of a lesson? Would you do that? Because it just might be that we have to. There's just that opportunity. We go, right, nobody knows this. I thought we did. Let's do it. So Joe's popped up there. Thank you, Joe. You've said that you've never added an objective, but you've amended them during a lesson. Of course. Yeah, absolutely. And maybe that's what I meant, actually. You know, maybe I did mean to amend it rather than to add a new one. Yeah, that's a really good point, because you might add a new one, but you're more likely to amend it, aren't you? Of course. So, I mean, adding them would probably happen. And I've just thinking of an example when I did this recently. I added one when, do you know what? It actually might be that I forgot to put it on. And let's be honest, as humans, we might just think, oh, do you know what? I've actually forgot to put that on there. And, you know, the students might even have a laugh at you for it as well. Hey, what you like, you know, just put it, you know, right, let's do it. Or it might be that you've got one thing to do and then, you know, the next step is just too much of a step and there needs to be a one stuck in there instead, just to make sure we put there as well. And Susan, you've said you've added an objective according to needs, and that's excellent. I wonder when you say according to needs, I wonder if that means, does that mean that you do it for a particular student, or would that objective still apply to everyone as well? Because I think that's a really interesting point, that you do that according to needs as well. If anyone would like to come on and have a chat, please feel free to call in. I'm very happy for you to join in. If I'm honest, I was lining up I was hoping to line up a guest for this show, but I think I'm quite new to the old concept of asking people to do things, and I wasn't quite there this time. But if anyone's listening, I said this at the beginning of the lesson. If anyone's here, at the beginning of the show. If anyone would like to come on as a guest in the future, what I'll do is I'll in advance tell you what the show is going to be on, or you could message me about something that you want to get to talk about, and I'm happy to create something around that as well. So if anyone wants to do that, but so it is different in each case, Susan, you said, and of course it is. It's probably the only answer you could have given there, really, isn't it? That it is different in each case. Of course it is. But the truth is that's a really good point. And the truth is we do need to do that. So the third one, again, sorry, was just to adapt the lesson in the moment and not necessarily the resource, which is a really good point. Now, the final one is to assess. Now, we kind of already discussed this, didn't we, with the whiteboards and everything as well, but we assess. So we look at the formative assessment that we're giving the student, whether that be a question, whether that be an activity. And the formative assessment, of course, is what is the outcome of that. And we can, of course, assess that based on the answers they give. And, of course, we say in the moment, of course, that might not be possible if the formative assessment is homework or if it's a summative assessment even. But, at least we are able to assess it in the lessons at the time, because, you know, every session should be questions. Every session should have formative assessments. And there's all sorts going on there, isn't there? So anticipate barriers, address barriers through planning, adapt your own lesson, and assess in the moment as well. Them four things are fundamental according to the Education Endowment Foundation, but also according to me, because I'm actually quite happy to support that as well. So what we're going to do is I'm going to take a look at another piece of research, and this comes from the Education-Based Evidence Review. And this is the other thing that has helped shape and put into practice my lesson plans as well.
This show is brought to you in partnership with John Catt Educational, publishing professional development books and resources to support great teaching and learning in schools around the world. Have you checked out their latest releases? Use the code JCTTR 2324 for 20% off your order. Don't miss out. Visit johncattbookshop.com to explore their full range of titles and advance your own professional development today. Happy reading.
So Susan has corrected me there. It is the Education Endowment Foundation. You're absolutely right. I'm just going to refer to them as the EEF from now on, because I always get that wrong. I'll be honest, I always get that wrong. I always say adaptive practice as well, when I should be adaptive teaching. And there's sometimes there's things that you just can't get out of your head. When you say it, you just can't stop saying it. So you're absolutely right. So just to clarify, that is the Education Endowment Foundation. So welcome back. And crucial, and just as a quick summary, what we've been looking at so far is, what is the difference between adaptive teaching? See, I said teaching that time. The adaptive teaching and the differentiation. What's the difference between them? And ultimately, the question is, how does adaptive teaching empower students more than what it does? Than what it does with differentiation. So, a crucial aspect of adaptive teaching is reframing our language. And I think it's very important to know that our students quite often I know if you're teaching in higher education, that might not be the case. So Nevin, you might have much older students, but most of our students are teenagers and very, very young. In fact, if you're listening from a primary school perspective, of course, they're even younger. So reframing our language is just so important, and you can't go far enough with this either. And we have different languages in our subjects, of course, and you know, especially in a subject again that they've never done before. So perhaps maybe Joe in history or with GCSE English with Toby, you might find that you use words that they just get because perhaps maybe they've done history before or they've done English since day one, you know, so they do that. But for law and politics, I have to use words like sovereignty. I have to use words like, you know, enumerated, and it's just not in their vocabulary whatsoever. So this tier three domain specific terminology really does need to be reframed. And by doing so, it's about recognizing that meeting student needs isn't an extra task, but it's an essential component of effective teaching. So this shift in perspective underscores the importance of adaptive teaching methods to support all student needs. But of course, in answering the question, it helps them empower the students as well. It helps them take ownership. So one way that they can help take ownership is by asking them to reframe the language for themselves. So is there a word, is there a phrase that you can anticipate that they will struggle with? Can you make a feature of this in your classes? Can you ask them, what do you think this word means? Using the whiteboards or using whatever to get them to do this. What is it that this word means? And you know, maybe perhaps by doing so, it works better for them. Now, I'll give you a very good example of this. So we have to use the word discharge in contract law. And I asked the students, what do we mean by discharging of a contract? And there was crickets. You could hear crickets because they just would never ever use that word. So I rephrased it. I instead said, okay, if I have a contract with someone and I want to discharge myself from that contract, what can I do? And just by answering that question, they were then able to say, you could tell them you don't want to do it anymore. You could stop your payments, or you could whatever. And you know, they got it that way as well. But that still didn't answer the question as to what the word discharge actually meant. So I just said, right, you know, in your own words, tell me what that word means. Now that you've got an understanding of it, and again, I would use the whiteboards to make sure that everybody had an understanding of it. You know, what does the word discharge mean? And there's probably about 10 different ways in which that can be done, and all 10 were mentioned by the students. There was one student who said that to discharge a contract is to destroy it, and they wrote it in capital letters, destroy, and they just laughed. I think they laughed about it. You know, the students laughed at that word destroy, but do you know what? He's not going to forget that now, and he thought of that himself. That was his word. He took ownership of the discharge of a contract by doing that. Others said get rid of it, and you know what, some might look at somebody else's whiteboard and write the same thing. That's fine. I can live with that. That's modeling. Students are modeling each other. But let's not forget that they need to be questioned on that if that is the case, just to make sure they get it. Okay. And you know, you sometimes get some really left field answers, but they've took ownership of it, and that's a really good example, a classic example of how adaptive teaching works. So the shift from differentiation to adaptive teaching marks a significant evolution in education as well, and I would even go as far as say a revolution, actually, because I just remember doing my teacher training, and differentiation was the buzzword. It was on its way out then, to be honest, but it was still the buzzword, and I remember my first learning observation, I had to show evidence of differentiation. I remember that now. And I did it, but it was hard work. The lesson observation of the day, I had to show adaptive teaching, and it just, I showed it so seamlessly because they were doing the work. You know, you give them the tools to do it. Whereas differentiation was just so difficult, I found. So I would use the word revolution as well as evolution in education. And it's inclusivity. It's all about inclusivity. That's a tough word to say. Inclusivity. There you go. I might change that for next time. It's about adapting to meet the diverse needs. So the education-based evidence review is also an excellent read. And when I say an excellent read, in actual fact, there's a poster that is nice and colourful, and I'm all about the colour. My lesson plans are all colourful. Everything's colourful. So this work colour works really well for me. And the poster basically tells you four clear things that's needed for great teaching. So if you get these four things in, that makes teaching great. So what are the four things? Well, I'll tell you them very quickly, because I think there's one or two that I find probably more important when discussing adaptive teaching. But nevertheless, we'll go through them all, so you can see what the four are. So again, this is evidence-based education, all right? And they did an evidence review, and they found these were the four things. So content. Believe it or not, you have to have good content. Who knew that? And the content has to be relevant and whatever. But the other three are things that maybe you would do, but you would never think of perhaps maybe to write down, or maybe you would, who knows. So the other three are maximizing learning opportunities, activating hard thinking, and creating a supportive environment. Now, adaptive teaching is enveloped into all four, but for me, the learning opportunities, so creating learning opportunities, or maximizing learning opportunities, sorry, activating hard thinking, of course, and supportive environment, them three things that are huge. Now, the activating hard thinking is something that I would very much like to tap into at another time, because this is your metacognition. This is your scaffolded questioning. This is the shift from from modifying tier three terminology. All these different things. Whether it's also behaviorist actions, or whether it's social, whatever it is, these are all sort of enveloped in that. And I would love to do just a session or a show just on activating hard thinking, and the supportive environment is for me is probably the most important one for adaptability. And Susan, you said you've worked in special needs for 10 years, and so you've had to adapt, and I can only imagine that creating that supportive environment is almost top of the bill for you, because of the learning needs, the specific needs. We are, and the Teacher Talk Radio have covered this on a few occasions, and I'm sure it'll pop up again, no doubt. But we are in a time when students' mental health needs are perhaps greater than they were even 2 or 3 years ago, let alone 10, 20 years ago. And we really have to think about this supportive environment aspect. And we really have to make sure that the students come in and they want to be here and they think it's a safe space. Safe space might sound a bit dramatic, but for some, other classroom environments or other parts of the college or school or wherever you are, there aren't safe spaces. So we need them to come in knowing that it's a safe space. And they can almost, it's almost like when you come into the class, it's like putting on your comfy pair of slippers, coming in, closing the door, putting your feet up, not literally, of course, but just doing what you do at home, or having that same feeling of safety that you do at home as well. And of course, that does tap into our adaptive practice as well, because, the situation about the whiteboard I mentioned earlier, it's absolutely fine doing that with students that you know. Don't mind getting the question wrong. You can rub it out. I've got one student I wouldn't dare do that with. I would not dare rub anything out because it would absolutely shatter their confidence. It doesn't matter that it's low stakes. It doesn't matter that they that they are learning from it. You just don't do that with them. Yeah, and I know that. Okay, so the support environment is such a big part of it. And I know, Susan, you mentioned hard thinking is vital. Of course it is. Absolutely it is. And if I, you know, if we had more time today, I would certainly love to tap into why I absolutely agree with you. But of course I will be doing that, and I do want to do that in future shows. So if you would like to speak on the show next time, Susan, please feel free to message me. I'll give you the details at the end again. If you would like to have your say on why hard thinking is vital, and especially if you're working with special education, specific needs, you know, your contribution to the show will be absolutely phenomenal. So yeah, I just like to say that the supportive environment is absolutely fundamental as well, because again, every student deserves to feel valued and included, and teachers must interact with all students, of course, ensuring that the teaching is culturally relevant as well. I think being culturally relevant is an entire thing as well, isn't it? Because you know, I teach American politics, and some of the phrases that we use in American politics doesn't quite land with my students because they are not used to seeing certain words being used like that. And you know, it's just because of the cultural differences, and if we can address that early on, then that can help with that as well. Because I don't want students to feel, certainly none of us want students to feel that their opinion on that isn't valued. So we can work on that as well, can't we, as part of the thing. But of course, great teachers understand that one size does not fit all. And, you know, the adaptive teaching that we refer to is sewn up by hard thinking and by the creative environment as well. But I was going to, at this point as well, I was just going to make the point that differentiation, however, is also one size doesn't fit all. So there are some things that we can talk about with differentiation that still links nicely with adaptive teaching. So you know, it's certain elements of the differentiation were good, but the one size fit all is certainly much more practical with adaptive teaching instead. Okay, so I think we're ready to answer the question now. I think we are. So if you are listening on the show, online, feel free to tap in anything that you've got that you'd like to share with me at this point about this. I'll repeat the question, but if you are listening back on the pods and you just want to, you know, you want to provide your answer to this, please feel free to use the my Twitter handle, which is ChrisW_1987. Or you can find me on LinkedIn as well. That's ChrisW_1987. Please share your answers with me and tell me what you've got, because what I like to do as a segment for the next show is compile all the different answers and just do a little recap with what people thought and how people did, because my voice might be the only thing you hear today, but I certainly want your voice to be heard as well, and I would love to do that in the future as well. So the question was, why do we think that adaptive teaching empowers students to take ownership of their learning journey more than differentiation? So what do we think for that one? I think at this point, it's well worth taking a look at some of the positives from differentiation, but just how it looks better with adaptive teaching. Now, Joe, you've thank you very much for your comment there. We've said they're not limited, and they're not. Now, this is a really excellent point, because we as A-level teachers, we don't have foundation, we don't have intermediate levels or higher levels. And Toby, as a GCSE English teacher, I know that you wouldn't have. There's what everyone does the one paper, don't they? And you know, with A-levels, we have to do that, and so why would we not give them absolutely everything and help them achieve that or help them get to that? Now, whether they actually achieve that or not is a different story altogether. But we should be looking for them to not be limited, as you say, Joe, and not to be capped by things, and use that time or use their time wisely, because every student in the class, every learner in the class, shouldn't feel like that they're wasting their time. Now, if I was to, just while people are sort of dropping some answers in, if I was to give you a case study quickly on what I mean by students wasting their time, if we take a look at a extreme, you know, the two extreme ends of a question, okay? So imagine one extreme is that the student absolutely does not know the answer to the question, okay? And then the opposite extreme, and I'm sure you can probably, in your own day-to-day practice, I'm sure you can think of someone who's in that position, and then someone who you know is going to take a minute to write an absolute world of an answer, and really, for what you're asking them to do, they've done it. Now, if you are in that position, and you can see that one student's finished and one student hasn't started, who do you go to first in that situation? Because they are at the extreme ends. So what that would suggest is that people in between are still working on it. But if you ask a question and there's one who's completely finished and they've got their arms crossed, and then you've got someone who isn't finished and in fact hasn't even started, and they've got their arms crossed. Now, we need to unfold their arms, don't we? And we need to make sure that time's used wisely, because one of the features from the education evidence-based education, as we said, was that we need to maximize opportunities to learn. So who do we go to first in that situation? Well, I think our reaction or our initial thought would be to go to the student who hasn't got anything written down. That would be our first reaction, I think. But I would implore you to do the opposite, because it just might be, and this might not be the case, I understand, but it just might be that they are still thinking. Now, if you've given them 5 minutes to do this, or 10 minutes, or however long, they are entitled, they have a right to them 5 or 10 minutes. So them crossing their arms doesn't necessarily suggest that they're doing nothing. It might be that they're thinking about it. They might have checked out, you know, at that point. And that's, this is where they're prone to maybe use their phones, or they're prone to start doing a little bit low level disruption or something. So we do have to act quick. We do have to get them we have to make sure that they are still thinking. But let's go to the other part first, though. Let's go to the student who's completed. I will go to them first, because they may be finished, but they're not finished at the same time. You can give them something that makes them progress on as well. And there's always this fear, and I know some of you might be shuddering at the thought that if a student finishes, it's almost they have to do something else. Why would you say that you finished early just to get more work to do? There's a way to avoid doing that, isn't there? And if you know your student well, you can actually give them a job without actually them knowing it. You can just ask them a question, but ask them in a way that, you know, it's not like you would normally. So, you know, for example, you might say, oh, they might give a word perfect definition. You might think, oh, that's brilliant, that. Hold on. Do you actually know what that means? Or what do you, or that word, do you think you could put it in a different way? Because, you know, the examiner might not know what you mean by that. And then boom, they're back on task. And then you can get straight onto this student who needs a bit of help. And you know, can we unfold their, how do we unfold their arms? Can we, you know, if they're using whiteboard, can you have your own pen? Can you prompt them with the first letter, write it on, and then that might give them a starting point? You know, I've actually even done hangman with one of them before. You know, just getting them to think of a word, I've quickly done it as a hangman, and they've done it that way instead. And, you know, in the end, they got the same answer. They just did it in a different way, I suppose. And so, yeah, either way, I think the student, if they've got their arms crossed, okay, two things might be going through their mind. Okay, either that their time has been wasted. So if you've completed the task and you're just sitting there with your arms crossed, their time's been wasted. Or it might be at the other end, the one who doesn't know anything, that they're wasting your time. They might think that they're wasting your time. And what a sad thought, isn't it, that a student can sit there thinking, oh, I'm wasting their time here. I'm never going to get this. And it's really sad. And of course, it's possible, but you could put those two students together and they could work. You know, there's loads of different ways of doing it. But it really is a sad notion to think that they might actually think that they're wasting your time, which is really sad. I'm just reading Susan's point there. So you said that if the quick one's autonomous, they will go on to their extension project, and absolutely, that's exactly right. And you know, that's exactly the point that we're making, isn't it? That they should be looking to try to do that as well. Now, looking at this, I think that maximizing learning opportunities falls lovely into adaptive preaching. I certainly won't be preaching adaptive teaching. Sorry, and just how they can, you know, how can you make every minute count? How can you get them to be doing that? And adaptive teaching is all about that, isn't it? It's adapting towards their needs, their but also their time as well. Now let's make sure that their time isn't wasted at all. So in terms of real life examples, these are just some of the examples I used, of course, and there's always going to be other examples as we go through. And I would love to hear from you, from any examples where your adaptive practice works really well. Because I love to hear how other people teach in these situations. And I love talking, because my college is so diverse with loads of different teaching. It's fantastic. I mean, I teach A-levels, but, you know, in a completely different part of the school, or different part of the college, you've got people teaching automotive, or you've got them teaching hairdressing or plumbing, and how they get their learners to do it, I find it really fascinating. So I will just give you, once again, I will give you my Twitter handle, okay? Now, I am just going to double check that it definitely is what I said it is, because it is brand new. Well, it's not brand new. I've had it for a while, but I've had to blow the dust off it. And I am glad I've checked, because I actually got it wrong there. Okay, so I'm going to put it into the, I'll put it into the chat. Now, for those who are listening online, listen to it back, I will give you it. I will verbalize it to you as well. So it is Chris_W 1987. Chris_W 1987. So if you would like to share your answers, I will have to get up this teaching. If you want to share your ideas with me as to how teaching practices work there, I would love to compile them and put out a post to show people how we are demonstrating adaptive practice as well. And if you've got any thoughts on why you think adaptive practice is moved on from differentiation, if there's anything I haven't mentioned that you think would be a good point to make as well, please do. And what I'll do is I will dedicate a section of the next show to some feedback from what you've said, so that we can build on it in the future. And what I would like to also do is I'd like to just thank you very, very much from the bottom of my heart for coming on and listening to my live show, and for being such a great audience as well, being interactive. It's absolutely, it's lovely. I was really nervous to do this today, if I'm honest, because my comfort, I find comfort in the classroom. I'm certainly not used to sitting behind a microphone, but I must say, I really enjoyed it. And I really hope that you have getting a lot out of this as well. And that first of all, you're able to understand me, because, there's always that fear that, I being a bit nervous, might talk too quick or whatever, I don't know. But hopefully you've had a very positive and engaging time with me today. And I would look forward to seeing you again, hearing from you again in the future. And finally, if you would like to appear on the show as a guest, please get in touch. Please let me know. And I will make sure that you have the platform for other people to hear how great your teaching is as well. So that is it for me for today. My name's Chris, and I will look forward to hearing from you again in the future. And for the rest of the weekend, have a lovely weekend before the rat race begins again, and I will see you all very shortly. Thank you.
You've been listening to Teachers Talk Radio. Tune in live and listen back at ttradio.org. We look forward to hearing from you next time on Teachers Talk Radio.